Good morning, everybody. It's 8 o'clock, so we'll get started. Stay on schedule. My pleasure to welcome you to the 18th Annual Montreal Institutional Investor Conference. My name is Bob Beck, CIBC's cable telecom and media analyst, and great to have you all here again this year. Kicking off again this year, I think we do this every year with BC. First off is BC. I don't have to explain to you what or who they are. Joining us again this year is Glen LeBlanc. Glen is Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. Welcome, Glen.
Thank you, Bob. Great to be here.
So usually we like to start off with a common theme amongst all our names. Sometimes we struggle for that. I think this one kind of jumps out this year, and that's regulatory. Obviously a big ramp up in regulatory noise and risk in the last year. So maybe if we could start with some of your big picture views on the risk environment for regulatory and, you know, some of the posturing we're seeing ahead of the election.
Yeah, no surprise, Bob, that we start here. I suspect that this would be the theme of the day. You said it's an election year, so I guess we shouldn't be surprised that there's going to be some posturing heading into October. Look, we were disappointed with the third-party internet access decision would be an understatement. To where I start. I don't understand where the government is going with this, offering access rates that are below our cost. Look, if you step back and you look at the big picture, Bob, we pride ourselves on having some of the best networks in the world, maybe with the exception of South Korea. Mm-hmm. And that's true in our wireless world, and that's true in our broadband. We hear a government for the past decade speak about a connected Canada and wanting to ensure that broadband access is available to all Canadians, rural or urban. And if we look at what's transpired over the past number of years, we look at the large incumbents making significant investments, spending billions in bringing fiber and bringing networks further and further across the country. These decisions are only going to stifle that investment, and I truly don't understand how we think that this will support a continued broadband rollout to all Canadians. If you look at the fact that there's a retro component to this decision, that's even more mind-boggling. You know, it's over $100 million for BCE and $300 to $350 million to the industry, with no ties to how that those funds are used. Well, what we know the funds won't be used for is network infrastructure. So we also know the funds won't be used for refunds to consumers. So this is a wealth transfer from the incumbents to the wholesale internet providers, and that one really is a head scratcher. I don't know how the government thinks that's going to advance the broadband agenda here in this country. So, Bob, I would say that one was a real disappointment. But the fact that everyone in this country has been so vocal—it's not just Bell or TELUS or Rogers or the large incumbents. This one has the voice of everyone behind it. Appeals are started. Most of the analysts have written that this one just doesn't make a lot of sense. And I don't know how the government thinks that this is going to advance our economy and advance our broadband agenda. It's a confusing decision.
Now, you mentioned there's some appeals. The cable guys have banded together. Anything coming on the telco side? Or?
We're doing our own. Same arguments as the cable. This one, we're all aligned in our opinion of what this does.
So as bad as the third-party rates and the retro goes, there's another element still to come on disaggregation on your fiber to the home, which obviously you've spent billions on, whether that's involved or included in this access to third parties. What are your thoughts on disaggregation?
Well, this decision, I guess, in some regards, is fearful in that is this the canary in the coal mine to what's going to happen with access to our fiber to the home. And that's the network of tomorrow. That's right. The network of the future. And certainly that would be incredibly disruptive to our ability to roll out fiber and have the economic return we require to continue to make the multi-billion-dollar investment that we alone at BCE are making. Right. You mentioned disaggregation. I guess we can hang our hat a little bit on that right now, that it is a disaggregated model, which means that there will have to be network backhaul constructed and put in place by the wholesale operators in order to get access to the final mile. So you can take some comfort in the short term that would be a sizable investment on their part. But yeah, if you ever move to an aggregated model, it could be incredibly damaging.
Do we have
to
a
the
sense
industry?
Do we have a sense of timing on that element?
No, we really don't. I think right now, let's hope that that our collective voices together can have everyone pause and look at what we're doing and try to come to a more rational and reasonable outcome on the last decision prior to moving on to what could potentially be a further decision.
Okay. So that's on the wireline side. We also have some wireless regulatory noise. We've got hearings starting on Jan 13th that is going to look into everything wireless ahead of the election. We've had some posturing ahead of that hearing about some elements that could be involved, including another MVNO discussion, so the ability for non-facilities-based players to get into wireless as well on your network. So maybe your thoughts on those hearings, and again, how much of this is posturing in BCE's mind versus an actual MVNO threat?
Well, we love to talk about MVNOs, particularly in election years. In non-election years, if you look back over the past decade, I would say, regardless of what government has been in power, rational minds have prevailed that we would continue to have a facilities-based approach to this. MVNOs love to garner headlines when you state that acronym, and I think that's where we're at right now. But if we look at what the government, regardless of the government in power, has attempted to accomplish in the last decade, the whole discussion of MVNOs, again, is struggling. Mm-hmm. The government pushed for a four wireless carrier model in Canada, and one could argue that that's even a challenge to get your head around when we look at what's transpiring in the U.S., which is likely a merger which is going to bring us to three carriers in the U.S. So if the U.S., with 10 times the population of Canada, can't support a four-carrier model, how the heck do we expect to support it here with our population? That said, there's been sizable investments made by the new entrants in Canada, and they're starting to get stability. They're starting to get their feet on the ground and start to enjoy the kind of the fruits of their investment in the early days. We know that this is a long game. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about the MVNO decision and how damaging it could be to our industry, the ones that are going to be hurt most in the front end of this is the new entrants. Mm-hmm. And that is who the government has been handing spectrum to and the free set-asides in order to prop them up to have a sustainable, successful fourth carrier in this country. Mm-hmm. To move to MVNO and have someone ride on their networks that are their investments are in their infancy, they haven't had any chance to earn the return on that investment, is going to be so destructive to that model. So let's wait and see. I don't understand how the MVNO can work in Canada. It makes no sense to me. And again, how vocal the industry has been together, not the incumbents against the new entrants. Our voices are completely aligned on this one. I think it's time that government pay attention to the investments that these new entrants and the incumbents are making. To 94% of Canadians have access on our network to LTE Advanced at average speeds of 260 megabits per second. They have access to 60% of Canadians have access to 750 megabits per second. These are world-class networks. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, our current LTE Advanced networks are faster than what the first generation of 5G will be on low-band spectrum. Yeah. Don't take that for granted. If you travel and you go into the U.S., you will realize the difference of our wireless networks and the quality here. So be careful.
Before we dig into the BC particularly, maybe just I'll throw it out to the audience if anybody wants to follow up on any regulatory questions at this point. Any questions in the audience on regulatory? Okay, let's dig in onto the BC. Wireless is a great place to start. You'd mentioned the long game on the wireless. We started to see some subscriber maturity starting to show up finally, but there's still a long tail here. So what are your thoughts on the subscriber element for your wireless business?
I would agree, Bob. There's a long tail here. We look at penetration curves in Canada, high 80s, 89%. In the U.S., north of 120 now. There is a long tail. If you look at our performance in the second quarter, 103,000 postpaid net adds, and we had 46,000 prepaid net adds. So our subscriber performance has been exceptional. We're very pleased. The quarter's not over yet, but all indications are that we'll have another strong mm-hmm. third quarter. The wireless landscape continues to be competitive with all the new entrants mm-hmm. and the multiple brands we have for discount brands and core brands. It remains very competitive, but it remains fairly healthy
right.
From a competitive landscape perspective.
Any dynamic changes east-west? You mentioned some of the new entrants you compete against.
Not really. I mean, it moves in ebbs and flows with promotional offers that move around the country, but no, nothing material.
Okay. You mentioned the prepay, which I think I wouldn't have this question for your competitors because they don't really have not had a big focus or success recently, but you have. You've got some good prepay execution, some growth, as you mentioned, 46,000 subs. What's behind the push into staying aggressive on prepay, and what's bringing the success?
Well, if we went back a few years ago, our largest wireless competitor was having great success in pre to post migrations. Right. When we started to kind of peel the onion of where the net subscriber growth was coming from in the industry, we felt that we were absent in a sector mm-hmm. Of that industry that could be quite fruitful to us. So we launched Lucky. Mm-hmm. Lucky Mobile, a new brand for us, a prepaid brand that we thought we could have some great success with. Put a great focus on our distribution network, which BC always mm-hmm. does, is ensure that we have the broadest and the largest distribution network. Mm-hmm. Signed a deal with Dollarama, put our Lucky product in Dollarama, and it's just been a great success. So the strategy with prepaid is to service a portion of the market that maybe it's new Canadians who haven't built a credit rating yet, and to build that brand loyalty to come to the Bell Canada or the BC group of mm-hmm. Of brands and establish a long-standing relationship, and then ultimately migrate them from pre to post and be a lifetime customer. And I think it's going exceptionally mm-hmm. well. Our net adds are demonstrative of that. And the fact that we were able to land such a great retailer right out of the gate in Dollarama to place our product in, it's been a great success.
I want to touch on now the other big move we've seen in the past couple of quarters, and that's the move to unlimited data. So Rogers introduced it, Bell and Telus were quick to match. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, I think it was eventually going to happen here, given what we've seen in the U.S. It may perhaps a bit earlier than expected. So your thoughts on the move to unlimited data on wireless would be helpful.
Yeah, I think it's premature. You said it. Bell didn't start this.
Yep.
We followed. We will always go into the market with competitive offers and ensure that our customers have mm-hmm. access to offers equally as rich and inviting as our competitors. But I thought this one was a bit early. I don't think this was something we expected quite as fast. Let's be honest, this will not be accretive to mm-hmm. ARPU in the short term.
Yep.
Data overages remained fairly significant in our industry in Canada, and this is going to ultimately reduce significantly the data overage mm-hmm. revenue that we earn. So it's going to have an effect on ARPU in the short term. Mm-hmm. In the long term, that said, it will simplify the offerings for right. customers. It will simplify the packages and the offerings that are in place, which ultimately means more self-serve is capable. It was easier for us and simplifies the manner in which we serve the customer in our contact center. So all of that should, in the long term, mean that servicing the customer should be easier and therefore cheaper. Mm-hmm. So I think there's benefits in the longer run that you'll see appear in the wireless margin. But in the short term, I think it's going to be an ARPU pressure.
Part of the Rogers move is also a switch to handset financing versus the subsidy model. You appear to be a bit more flexible between models. What are your thoughts on the handset?
I think this is a good move. The EIP, as we refer to it mm-hmm. in the industry, I think it gives consumers choice. Mm-hmm. We know that the handsets that are coming into market now are quite expensive, and if we look at the ability for Canadians to get access to affordable wireless, certainly a platform that our government speaks on. Mm-hmm. The EIP is helpful in that it gives you an avenue to finance that device mm-hmm. as opposed to having to come up with $200 or $300 or $400 or $500 up front. I think we should actually move to a 36-month financing. Mm-hmm. I know the CRTC has kind of put that on hold while they do their studies and research on whether or not that's the best thing for Canadians. But if what we're focused on is ensuring that Canadians have access to wireless handsets and the best of technology at affordable prices, that certainly allows you to amortize it over a longer period of time, and I think would meet the government's needs. So we are moving in that direction. In July, we started matching the EIPs. We've tried to be flexible with customers and offer both. Frankly, we had quite a bit of IT work to get done in order to move into the EIP, so we were a little slower out of the gate matching our competitors, but you see us migrating that direction now. And I think this has the ability, if the industry moves there in totality, this has the ability to reduce subsidies, which will be healthy for margins and which will be healthy for EBITDA. And I think if we do that in conjunction with moving to a longer duration, a longer amortization period of 36 months, I think this could be a real win for the consumer, ultimately a win for government in their platform of ensuring affordable wireless. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be good for our industry.
Okay. I wanted to step back on ARPU. You'd mentioned a bit of the near-term headwinds that come with the unlimited plan. What are your overall thoughts on the current ARPU environment for the Canadian wireless, please?
Yeah, I think you'll continue to see growth, Bob, but as I said in my earlier remarks, it's going to be under a bit of pressure. I think it's closer to the 1% that you'll see than we were, you know, 1.5-ish in the first half of the year. And I think the unlimited plans are going to put a little bit of pressure on that right out of the gate.
Okay. One tidbit I wanted to ask you about. TELUS, your competitor TELUS, changed the disclosure on handsets versus devices. What are BC's thoughts on the way you report currently
I'm very comfortable in the way we report currently, but that said, I truly understand where TELUS is going and why they did that, and it required us to pause and think ourselves. When you look out to the future of 5G and connected devices, you really need to think about your subscriber base differently, mm-hmm. as you're going to be earning revenue sources from a wide range of devices that could earn you anything from pennies mm-hmm. of ARPU to you know the prices we you know the 60s and 70s we earn today on a postpaid customer. For us, it was a little bit premature. We're not ready to go there just yet. We mm-hmm. think 5G is still a couple years out, so we didn't want to remove the current reporting we do for our shareholders. So, you know, wait and see. But I certainly understand why TELUS did it, and I think long term there could be some merit.
So it's perhaps a good segue into 5G. As you mentioned, you know, probably a couple of years out here in Canada. But you know, any more thoughts on your preparation for that? And obviously the Huawei situation is fluid there. But maybe just an update on your views on you know the equipment that you've already invested in with Huawei and what's going on with the government.
That Bob, you're right. That's a wait and see. What's happening with Huawei, as you know, they're not in our core network. Right. They're in our radio access network. We utilize Huawei for our 3G and our 4G deployments. We have not made a decision on a supplier for 5G. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a wait and see. We have the ability to move in many directions here. We're just starting an RFP process, and we will ensure that we have multiple suppliers bidding. We'll respect the government's decision, whichever way they go. We think that having Huawei in the radio access network is the right thing to do. But let's see where the government goes with that. We can manage the shift and the movement to a different supplier and ultimately the removal of that equipment inside of our capital program. Sure. It's not overly material. Now, on the 5G discussion and our readiness for 5G, mm-hmm. you know, our fiber program is ultimately mm-hmm. a 5G readiness program mm-hmm. in many regards, in that we're connecting all of our small cells mm-hmm. and to fiber. And for 5G, you need fiber backhaul, and that is a huge competitive advantage we have over our largest wireless competitor, in that we have fiber everywhere now. I think we're 85% of our cell sites are now connected to fiber. You need fiber backhaul in order to deliver the low latency that's required on 5G. So we're in great shape, feeling very good about that. Also feel very good heading into the 3.5 spectrum auction that we find ourselves with 25 to 30 megahertz of spectrum across the country now through our Nookshook partnership. Yep. So 5G readiness, I don't know that anybody's better positioned than we are. 3,500 is the critical spectrum, and then ultimately post that you'll have millimeter waves. So we have multiple key auctions in front of us over the next number of years for 5G. You know, there's lots of talk about us not acquiring 600.
Yep.
And we just didn't require 600. It's not critical 5G spectrum. We have 700. We did a shutdown of our CDMA network, which allowed us to refarm 850. So we have all kinds of low spectrum. And as I said, early 5G deployments on low band spectrum is going to deliver a network that's not as fast as our LTE advanced network. So we're comfortable with cell splitting and readying ourselves for what is the real 5G deployment on 3.5.
Do you see a change at some point on the value of spectrum for you and other players? Is it all more spectrum is all? Well, I guess not all spectrum, but more spectrum is better, even if it's not 600.
Look, it continues to be, you know, a very important asset for all of us, and some spectrum will have greater value than others, and with, you know, a global standard starting to focus in on 3.5 for 5G, that will be important in critical spectrum. As you said, not all spectrum has value depending on your network infrastructure. And for us, with having 700 and 850, 600 wasn't that. But look, spectrum will continue to be valuable, and BC will certainly ensure its balance sheet is healthy enough to participate in these critical spectrum auctions.
Excellent. So I'm going to move to wireline from here. Anybody with a wireless question they want to get in that wasn't asked? Anyone? Okay, so turning to wireline, you mentioned fiber a few times on supporting your wireless business, but obviously you've been deep into a fiber build. Maybe give us a bit of a sense as to where that build stands and maybe some of the success rate that you've seen in areas where you've lit up your fiber. How is it changing the marketplace?
Well, the strategy has been a consistent one, and that is continue to roll out fiber further and further to our customers. Ultimately, we'd like to see 9 to 10 million of our homes passed with fiber. We're north of 5 now, so we're past the halfway mark. And we have a very simple strategy when we roll out fiber. It delivers the best network in the world, and when you have network superiority, or at least network equivalency, then you should be able to take your fair share of market share, and there should be market share equilibrium. We operate in many of our territories with 38 and 39% market share, as the cable companies took significant share from us in many of our territories over the years. As we roll out fiber, that is our metric, is that we expect to take 50% of every net new add, and we are doing that. And if you continue to do that in every community you roll out, then you know that's a pickup of 1% to 2% market share, and I think we can continue to do that in fiber. So our fiber program has been exceptional. We're very excited about, you know, the next 4 million homes. Mm-hmm. And then you lay on top of that our wireless to the home strategy now, which is allowing us to access about another million homes to bring broadband to areas that, frankly, were grossly underserved by DSL or, heaven forbid, still dial-up in some of those areas. So we think, you know, if you look at 12 million homes and you can get to 9 and 10 of those with fiber and a million of those with wireless to the home, that gives us the ability to serve the vast majority of our footprint with high-end broadband.
Mm-hmm. And how are you seeing the take-up in those markets? I mean, that's
phenomenal.
Giant...
Those markets are markets we lost many, many years ago. Yeah. I mean, they would have, you know, 10 to 20% market share if we're lucky, maybe lower than that. So when you roll in with a 25 meg product right now, working to expand that to 50, and then ultimately on our 5G network, we can think we can take that to 100 gigs. To 100 megs. It's a real offering. So take up has been great success. we were very excited. This started with a, you know, maybe a vision that there was a 500,000 homes or 600,000, and eventually we expanded that to 800,000. Made an announcement that we'd take that to 1.2 million. Unfortunately, we rolled back that investment to a million homes.
Right.
Government's decisions around the third-party internet access rates make it very difficult for us to make this investment while somebody else rides our rails.
Yeah, no doubt. The last mile, the wireline, the fiber, it's really a function of internet market share, as you say. What kind of pricing power do you think you still have in this market? It's maturing, but there's still, you've got market share to gain, but is there still pricing power in the market for internet?
I believe there is. I think if we look at the way bandwidth is becoming so critical in the home and the need for greater and greater speeds, the number of connected devices in the home, you know, frankly, there's few products in your home that are more critical to you than your broadband pipe right now. So,
very true. Just on TV, wanted to touch on one question. The Alt TV, your skinny TV offering, how's that faring? Again, last year, I think with the early startup was promising, and that year in, what do we think about that as a product for
millennials? It continues
perhaps
to be very promising, and when we launched Alt TV, it was dipping our toe into the to a different TV market.
Yeah.
You know, the multiple set-top devices in the home, that was our core product. But when we looked at the evolving consumer needs and wants, if you're a student and you live in a home, a small condo, maybe one to two TV sets is all you need, and you're not interested in delivery on a 55 or 65 inch mm-hmm. TV. You watch it on your tablet or your PC, and I know that's how my children consume content today. So Alt TV is a streaming TV service that allows us to deliver a product to that segment mm-hmm. at a reduced price, but a protected margin. And what I mean by that is we can reduce the price on that product because we have no in-home electronics. We do not roll trucks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a self-serve a connection. So if you reduce the contact center call and you reduce the truck roll, and I don't have to spend the CPE,
right,
the customer prem equipment, then the margins are protected. So very pleased with that product. It's evolving to what ultimately I think TV delivery is going to look like one day. Is mm-hmm. it's going to be an over-the-top streaming delivery, and maybe one day set-top boxes will continue to exist for high-end customers and delivery, but frankly, it's an area, it's a segment of the market we need to understand better, and Alt TV is doing that for us.
Okay. I want to use the last few minutes just to focus on one of the key strengths of BC, and that's free cash flow generation and return of cash to shareholders. So maybe just update us your thoughts on your free cash flow profiles, and again, that'll lead to a dividend growth comment, I'm sure, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, a lot more of the same, Bob. I think what you've seen from us in the past is that we're committed to an investment-grade credit rating on our balance sheet, so not taking actions that put that in jeopardy, and the current rating we have. We're committed to growing our dividend, ensuring that shareholders get a dependable, predictable dividend each year growing, mm-hmm. albeit respecting our 65 to 75% mm-hmm. payout ratio. So really nothing has changed. I think I've said it many, many times that our focus internally is all about balance.
Mm-hmm.
We talked at great length today about networks, and mm-hmm. our networks require investment, and they will continue to require investment. So ensuring that we're making the necessary investments in fiber, in 5G, and continue to be a leader in this country with the best networks
mm-hmm.
is important. So you need to respect your dividend policy in giving your shareholders that predictable, dependable, respect your balance sheet, but not on the back of reducing the necessary mm-hmm. investments in network. You manage that three-legged stool as we've done brilliantly over the past mm-hmm. Decade, and I think all stakeholders will benefit.
Okay. You talked about your debt goals, but what IFRS 16 has kind of twisted the math a little bit, but do we have a debt target that we can work with that makes
well,
sense?
We had a 175 to 225 target out there, and with the changes of IFRS 16, we changed that to a high end of 2.5, and I think that's a good target.
Okay.
The rating agencies are all right now looking at what their rating should be with IFRS 16
right.
and whether it requires a slight boost to what their high end of their targets
mm-hmm.
were. But You know, in this low interest rate environment, let's be honest, it's hard to want to go and pay down a debt. We just did a 10-year at 2.9, and it's just remarkable of what you can borrow money for these days. So all of that said, we're not going to take on actions that jeopardize the current rating.
Question on M&A. You've been quite active over the years supporting a wireline business materially. It doesn't appear to be any reasonable targets out there to kind of continue that strategy.
We're always looking at tuck-ins, and we'd be remiss not to. There's small little acquisitions that we make throughout the year. Many of them probably fly right under the radar. Yeah. But you're correct, Bob. When you look at the Canadian landscape, where we want to remain and not move outside of our borders, there's not much left. We certainly feel we have the media assets we need, and there was even a transaction we tried to do last year that the Competition Bureau wouldn't allow to go through on some small media assets. So I think we're right-sized there. I don't know that you'll ever see a Western province move again and whether they want to divest of that asset, but that's the only significant government-owned entity left in the country. So for us, stick to our knitting, invest in fiber, invest in our networks, invest in customer service, and look, if something comes available that's in our industry, you can be sure we'll be there.
Excellent. Thank you. We're out of time, so that's a good place to stop. And please join me in thanking Glenn for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you.